You're listening to KHEN LP FM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio, and that was Black, a local group, and the song was Can't Explain. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, we're available at www.givemesometruth.info are linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email is khen.dj@gmail.com. And I'm Melody, and my co-host is Katie this evening. And Kate, I lost my underwriting. There is my form, and support for KHEN and Truth Quest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Katie and Dr. Begich, are you there? Katie and Dr. Begich, are you there?
I can just barely hear you, Melody.
You can just... Still not, huh? Dr. Begich?
I can hear you. It's a little faint, but I can hear you.
Okay. Let's see.
I'm going to try yet a different phone. Hold on.
Okay, all right. Well, let me go first get into what Dr. Begich is. The eldest son of the United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He is well known in Alaska for his own political activities. He was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He's been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Dr. Begich received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in November of 1994, and he co-authored with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. Begich has also authored Earth Rising, The Revolution Toward a Thousand Years of Peace, and his latest book, Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul, both with the late James Roderick. He's also the editor of Earth Pulse Flashpoints, a new science book series. Begich published his articles in Science, Politics, and Education as a well-known lecturer, having presented throughout the United States and in 19 countries. He's been featured as a guest on thousands of radio broadcasts, reporting on his research activities, including new technologies, health, and earth science-related issues. He's also appeared on dozens of television documentaries and other programs throughout the world, including the BBC-TV, CBC-TV, Telemundo, and others. Dr. Begich, is there anything more you'd like to add to that?
There's always a lot of things that happen since the last bio was written. We actually wrote another book, Controlling the Human Mind, and produced a number of videos as well. But nonetheless, we continue to get involved in technology issues, and that's really been our hallmark over the last 15 years. And you know, the subjects we'll probably get into tonight will touch on a number of those. And you know, how technology affects us has so changed the way in which we live just in one generation. And you think about what our grandparents and our great-grandparents experienced and the conversations I actually had as a kid with mine. And yet we are going to see in the next 10 to 20 years changes that make what we've already seen pale in comparison. I mean, the acceleration rate and where it takes us from quantum computing to mapping the mind to really understanding human physiology, the health sciences, the earth sciences, all of it is going to be revolutionized with the technologies of this century.
And before I get too much further, let me say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Dr. Begich, are you doing a radio program now at this point?
No, actually, I work primarily. I was doing hosting my own program for a couple of years, and it was interesting and it was useful in being able to get a lot of issues, into the record. But I've worked with about 250 radio producers around the country and around the world, and it just allows us to reach a lot more people. So doing programs like this, we reach people that otherwise would never hear what we have and what we're talking about. So we went back to sort of that model, which had worked really well for us. But, you try different things along life's way, but it was a great way to lay down some information in the record. And a lot of that is, actually, I think there's 90 hours of that's free on our website at earthpulse.com that people can just go to and they can, click and play. And it's, we didn't index them in any particular way except by date, but, they all cover a lot of subject matter and pretty interesting audio material, and it's free.
Okay, and don't you also have some other things that are available on that website as well?
Oh, yeah, all our books, all our videos, all that kind of stuff is there, as well as a lot of the technologies that are sort of the other side, ways to enhance human brain performance, way to enhance health, things that are, conducive to what we're about as human beings, at least we think so, and things that we use ourselves. So that's there. But a lot of information as well, a lot of articles that are free are posted there, and we just encourage people to go there, use the information as you will, and if you see something that's useful, it supports us, keeps us in this work, and we appreciate it when people pick up a book or a video.
Well, great. Katie, did you find another phone?
I did. Can you hear me now?
I can. Can you?
I can. It sounds much better.
Okay,
oh,
great.
Excellent.
Well, is
technology?
There
here we are.
Yeah.
Starting out the show, trying to get a phone that works.
Sometimes it can be the hardest. Absolutely. What have they discovered, or you discovered, in regard to the HARP project? Since angels don't play this harp.
Well, HARP was set up as a developmental prototype, and for those that have followed the story and understand what it is, it was a radio broadcast, a field of antennas erected here in Alaska for a number of purposes, but primarily what was unique about it is it allowed us to focus or concentrate radio frequency energy into a relatively small area, and compared to the way radio broadcast normally works is from the broadcast station, the signal spreads out real rapidly and becomes less and less dense in terms of energy concentration. It happens really fast. I mean, when you get right up to the broadcast point, there's a lot of energy, but get, you know, 20 miles away and there's, you know, significantly less, and it dissipates rapidly. But if you could focus it, like focusing the light in a laser as opposed to the light coming off of a flashlight, you know, that same kind of analogy, the idea was you could manipulate this in a lot of different ways and literally plug in to sort of the electromagnetic components of the planet, which include the magnetic field lines that encircle the Earth, as well as other aspects of the fields that interact with the planet. And so the idea was initially to create a missile shield by sending energy up and accelerating energy that was in place in the ionosphere, an area about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, in a manner that would allow us to create a cold plasma and a shielding sort of effect, so that if any missile or sophisticated aircraft or satellite went through that area, they would encounter such a shock or such a disruption to their electronics that they would malfunction and fail. So it started out as sort of that kind of a project, and it morphed into a lot of other things when you start to think about, you know, what could you do with this instrument. And so the developmental prototype was built here, and it's expanded over the years, and today there are several facilities that have been retrofitted to replicate what this one does, but it has a number of communications and military applications beyond the one I just described that make it a, you know, pretty interesting instrument. So what they've done over the years since the book came out is they've tested some of these ideas and proven the concepts work, like earth-penetrating tomography, which in simple language means looking into the Earth or imaging the Earth at depth so you could get a couple kilometers down and know exactly what was there in terms of underground nuclear facilities is one example, or on the other side of the coin, oil and gas deposits or other kinds of mineral deposits that can be easily distinguished one from another with a high degree of accuracy with this kind of earth-penetrating tomography, which they've demonstrated. In fact, that becomes a really interesting technology because they also used it, a similar technology, ground-penetrating tomography by satellite or by at least orbiting craft in Mars when they image, you know, the polar regions several kilometers down for ice and water and other kinds of materials. The thing about this kind of imaging, if you look at it in terms of even public policy, if we were to image all of the public lands that the United States had as an example, we could determine all of the underlying minerals, all the underlying gas fields, coal, geothermal, all those things that we're interested in through imaging technologies that we have today. And then instead of giving these things away to oil companies, whatever we were going to do in, say, natural gas fields, we could develop ourselves, and it wouldn't be wildcatting. It'd be pretty efficient and pretty cost-effective because you'd never miss, and use it as a bridge fuel to, you know, the more sensible technologies of renewable energies. But, you know, these kinds of things that we pay for, you know, that's the amazing thing, is we bought all this technology, not just for HEART, but we've also got the same kind of technology, obviously, with NASA, because they're doing it all around the solar system, except and they're probably doing it here as well, but we're not getting full public use of that data. And this is, again, something very important because, you know, you've got technologies now that change sort of the playing field on a lot of things, and including, I think, minerals and oil and gas. Because in the old days, when there were big risks associated with that, the laws were written in 1872 that have not significantly changed, you know, in terms of, you know, what it takes to go out and locate and take those away from the public treasury and into private hands. So today, I think we kind of should reevaluate the way in which we lease properties to make sure the public gets full benefit and, you know, full value. And our technologies support that. And yet we're not, you know, we're sort of the bad bargainers in the deal. And instead we increase the national debt when we could, in fact, sort of think about our technology and how we utilize public resources in a different way and maybe solve our problems at the same time.
When you were talking, I recently had run across some an old coast-to-coast program that was speaking about a Mr. Kagan. Does that name sound familiar with to you?
It doesn't ring a bell, but I'm not so good with names as I am with data. So.
Okay. Well, the reason why I was going to bring it up, it had to do with he was getting into the kind of like a space platform that might have been solar, and it was supposed to be... Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the space platforms is part of that. It has been part of that early concept on HARP, and you know the solar idea of charging them up. Because here's the trick: is you got a space platform, how do you get fuel to it? You got to have a local fuel source. You got to think, well, what do I have available to me? And solar without the atmosphere is certainly one option. But do you remember the tether experiment when they had that long cable hanging from a space shuttle and they drug it through the ionosphere and then it created such a static charge and almost blew the shuttle out of the sky? And what that was about was when you put, there's a lot of energy in the ionosphere, and when you put a moving conductor through it, it conducts and moves that energy, and you know, they got exactly what they figured. But there's energy available there that you can tap and use for these low-orbiting space platforms. One of the things with HARP was, by focusing radio frequency, in fact, was the first things that they demonstrated was the ability to send energy efficiently enough so that you could keep charge on an indefinite basis, virtually indefinite basis, these low-orbiting space platforms, which means you can then operate your weapon systems, you know, anywhere on the planet and have absolute, you know, clear, you know, line of sight over huge bodies of land. And the thing about this is the amount of energy available in this area is more energy than we could ever think about producing on Earth. And it's naturally available. And so if you can tap the energy and then you put it into space-based lasers, which is where this technology takes us, now you have weapons that can launch enough power and enough punch. And you have other energy-based weapons that have been developed over the last several decades. The biggest trick was, you know, some hurdles in technology that have been overcome. But what it really amounts to is weapons that travel not at 30,000 miles an hour, which would be like around the Earth, you know, once with a little extra time to spare in an hour. The speed of light weapons, which is what we're talking about, they travel 186,300 miles per second. That's, you know, traveling around the Earth seven times with a little time left over in a second. So when you talk about low-orbiting space platforms and conjunction with new technologies as they're being developed in this decade and in the last couple of decades, it changes everything once again, because you can annihilate a country literally in the flash of an eye. And that's where a lot of this technology takes us, and why there's so much discussion, or at least there's emerging discussion, I should better say, about this idea of moving weaponization into space, because then we really have even bigger and magnified problems. Especially when you consider the Bush concept of preemptive warfare that he introduced to the world, that says, hey, if you think he's a bad guy, just wipe him out and figure it out later. Well, that can be applied against the inventor of the idea just as easily as we applied it when we were the toughest guy in town. And these technologies, speed of light weapons particularly, are changing the game dramatically, and the technology is getting flatter, which means it's accessible to more and more people. And so, you know, HARP is sort of one small piece of the puzzle, and it's where our work started, which is why a lot of people still go back to it. And it's an important issue, very important issue, because when you start to think about tapping the natural forces of the Earth as your energy source, or coupling with those natural components to change them or alter them for your own benefit, there's consequences to that, and there's also potential benefits, but the path has to be an open one, number one, and a very slow one, and one that we really do a lot of discussion about before we engage it in the way many of these systems, such as HARP, have been engaged.
How are the chemtrails involved in HARP?
I don't believe they are at all. I've never seen any compelling evidence that I would call evidence that would meet my standard of evidence on the subject. There's others following the chemtrails issue. I'm not. You don't need anything, you know, in the atmosphere. And the story goes that they're dropping barium and aluminum, and that this enhances the effect. And yes, it probably would, but it's not necessary. And I think that's the point that should be made, as well as barium is put in the atmosphere for other reasons. It's if you put barium in, as an example, in with HARP, they actually launch rockets from Poker Flat Rocket Range near Fairbanks and discharge a very fine particulate material of barium. And then when they engage HARP to create a certain effect, that gives them a visual image of where that energy is going. So in this case, it lights up the magnetic field line, and then they can corkscrew energy around it, so you could literally look like a spring wrapping around that line, and they can light it up so you can see that kind of image using barium. And so some of that's associated in that way in the case of aluminum, you know, there's a lot of controversy about aluminum in the natural environment, but the simplest thing I can point to is there was a doctoral dissertation done some time ago, and it was actually later made into a book called The Secret Life of Dust, and it was by, I try to remember her name, and it just doesn't click right at the moment. Yeah, here we go. Heather Holmes was the name. And she, Hannah Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S. And what she found is that huge amounts of aluminum were blowing in from the North Africa and in to the southern United States, as one example, on that side. And this was discovered when they found a bauxite, which is aluminum ore, deposited on top of a coral bed, which is an organic material. And they couldn't figure out how this happened. They began to look at it, and they discovered that it had formed over millions and millions of years by dust coming over from the Sahara in North Africa. And when you think of the orange soil in the southeast, which has got a lot of aluminum in it, that's the reason, that's the dust flow from that direction. The other side of the earth, you have China, Southeast Asia, and at this point, and at the point which that dissertation, which is now well over 10 years old, was put together, that whole West Coast was from Vancouver and north of Vancouver all the way down to California, Mexico, depending on the way the jet streams were going, were dumping all of this particulate material from Asia and from industrializing China, which is industrializing at a rate that's just nothing has ever been like this in the world history. And the amount of particulate material coming in, particularly aluminum particulates, as well as those that, again, naturally occurring or for other industrial reasons occurring in the U.S. And so when I start to look at some of the chemtrail debate and discussion, we stayed away from it. And the reason we did is there was so much mixed information, bad sampling, not enough consideration of other possibilities. We felt we'll leave it to those that are chasing it. It's just not going to be our issue. And so, and as we looked at it with HARP, in the very beginning, one of the very first players in that discussion came to me and said, look, I want to tie this to HARP because everyone's following HARP, and this would be a good way to draw attention to this issue. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. Okay, so, you know, that's where I'm at on chemtrails as it relates to HARP. I'm not following the chemtrail story to any great degree, but certainly with the way HARP can be utilized, you don't need anything that I've heard about in people who have sent me lots of material over the years.
You certainly have. I mean, what I was observing on some of the videos, that there are a lot of uses for HARP, so, and some of them aren't necessarily positive uses. Do you want to get into any of that at all, or?
Sure. I mean, the things that are that show up is, you know, things like weather modification, you know, triggering geophysical events like earthquakes, you know, this kind of stuff by manipulating, again, natural fields within the earth to release energy that's already there, essentially creating an instability where there wasn't one before, whether it's in the ionosphere, whether it's in the earth or weather systems. And this was a lot of the work that the inventor, Bernard Eastland, and he became a good friend of mine over the years. He passed away in 07, in December of 07, unfortunately. And, you know, in fact, there's a good video clip of him presenting on some of his ideas, including HARP. And he gives sort of the good side, bad side on the various technologies, because, you know, there always is. And one of the things that, you know, I think he and I really learned together in terms of expressing it out there in the public was the idea that, you know, there always is two sides to the story. We need to really think about that when we're developing big science, because we can make big mistakes with big science. And that's, and I think that's where, you know, science gets a little bit arrogant, you know, and everybody specializes. Nobody's an expert in anything, really, I mean, ultimately, because information does change and knowledge expands. And, you know, we need to recognize that multidisciplinary approaches probably yield better results when we're talking about big science. And in our country, we've traditionally, on the really important science, done the opposite. We do compartmentalization, where we separate the sciences for security reasons, because most of our big science happens to be related to a national defense, if you look at where the money's spent. And so, you know, and then we over-specialize, so you don't get any cross-fertilization, which oftentimes is quite useful. In fact, that's what the opposite model was used in the former Soviet Union. It was a cross-fertilization model where they used multidisciplinary teams to approach big science issues. And as a result, they felt they had a more comprehensive view, and the real result was they kept up with us, you know, with a lot less of an economic engine behind them, at least technologically. In many respects, they kept up with us. In other respects, they even surpassed us.
Are there those antenna arrays, are there numerous ones around the world?
Yeah, actually, the very first ones, speaking of the Soviet Union, were there. I mean, in fact, people go back to the 1970s, and they remember a controversy over something called the Woodpecker signal. And what this was a signal being broadcast from five broadcast stations out of the Soviet Union that had that kind of a pecking sort of sound, and it was a low-frequency signal that people associated with brain activity in human beings. They associated with geophysical events. They associated with power grid manipulation by being able to knock out or short out power grids. There were a lot of assertions about the early, what we would call today a HARP array, but much more primitive in terms of technology. To change the frequency, for example, in the old units, it would take you 15 minutes. The new HARP system can do the same thing in a millisecond. You know, so you have the ability, because of the technology changes since the 70s, to do much more with radio frequency energy than you could back then. And see, that's the thing that folks really need to recognize, is that these old technologies we thought were such a threat, from the invention of the wheel to where we are right now, this moment, about every 9 months, technology doubles. And that's accelerating. It used to be every 5 years back in the 1980s, and it used to be every 100 years, back a century ago or even more, from the time you maybe discover something to make it really happen. And now technology happens in months, from concept to product. The timeline has shortened. And at the same time, new science concepts advance based on our increases in computing power, which we're about to make a huge leap there. When we master, and we are very close to it, a way to constitute functionally operating quantum computers, that will change everything. And let me give you the example of why. If you think about a supercomputer today, they do about the maximum, maybe 280 to 300 teraflops a second. I think the last one measure that I read about was 2 years ago at 280 teraflops a second. And that equals 6.6 billion people with hand calculators every 5 seconds doing a calculation for 60 hours to do what that computer does in 1 second. Now, that's huge. But a quantum computer, now imagine the one I just described, that supercomputer of the day, running for a trillion years. Can you imagine how much computing that is? For a trillion years, a quantum computer will do it in an hour. Now,
is that what CERN is? Is that what CERN is? A quantum?
Excuse me?
Is that what CERN is?
The supercomputers over there?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You've got a couple things. There's supercomputers in Switzerland right now. There's three of them actually being tied together, and they're being used to do brain mapping. Except here's the thing about that project, is the brain mapping project allows you to get one neuron firing chain in three dimensions using three supercomputers tied together. Now, what that says two things. First of all, it says that we have very complicated, it's going to take a lot more computing power to get full mapping of the human brain in a meaningful way. But at the same time, it says something about the human brain as a computer. We already have a quantum computer. It sits between our ears. And we've never learned to fully engage it yet. When we do, it changes everything, too. So when you look at technology, it's sort of a mirror of ourselves. And I think during the very beginning of this program, before we went on the air, we were talking off air about the comment was, it's too bad we don't get this spiritual side moving, but maybe these things run in tandem. And I think they do, because our technology is a reflection of ourselves. We always try and replicate nature with our technology. It's just our intentionality behind that sometimes gets a little screwed up.
How does the HARP affect human brain functions?
That's another important issue, because what was discovered back in the 1960s, actually, in fact, there was a book called Unless Peace Comes, and it was a chapter called How to Wreck Your Environment. And within that was a quote by G.F. Gordon MacDonald, who was geophysicist at UCLA and a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson when he was president. And he suggested that if we could ever electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal back to the Earth that would manipulate the behavior over huge geographic areas. And that's essentially what HARP can do. And what the signal he was talking about was, it turns out that an external signal, and this was discovered by a guy named Delgado back in the 60s, as well as advanced into the 80s. And what they discovered is that you could modulate a signal, pulse a signal, in such a way that the brain, predominant brain activity, would show up as mirroring that signal. In other words, you could send a signal in that was, for instance, just a simple analogy, you could send a signal in that would make someone passive, tired, lethargic, or you could send a signal in that would create a highly agitated state. And it's a matter of knowing sort of what pulse rate, exactly what pulse rate to pump into a window frequency that will affect the brain. The brain will create a frequency following response, or what's in the literature an FFR. And what happens is the brain begins to lock onto that external signal, mirror it, and as a consequence, there's chemistry changes, chemical changes, and brain state changes, and it's almost like flipping on and off a light switch. They did this in the mid-80s. They did this with radio frequency energy by just pulsing that energy in such a way. And the energy density or the concentration they used was 1/50th of what the Earth naturally produces, which, let me just put that into perspective. That is so little energy. It's amazing that the brain could even pick out the signal, because behind that energy is what man's created, which is 200 million times more than the Earth naturally creates. So instead of 1/50th, you've got 10 billion times more energy density and radio frequency around you, but we're such a fine-tuning instrument that we can pick out these very faint signals and respond to them. And that's a very important observation, because that in that lies sort of the underlying threat to this technology. The thing is, we always lock on to the stronger signal. So if we're close proximity to, say, the power grid oscillating at 60 cycles, you know, that creates generally a state of tension. In fact, you can notice the state of tension when the power fails in your area. The first thing most people recognize is how quiet it gets. The second thing you recognize is your whole body almost takes an exhale as you relax. And as I'm saying it, people recall this, because when that energy leaves the room, and you're no longer oscillating or trying to compensate for that high-frequency oscillation, which to the body is a high-frequency oscillation because we like it calm and quiet somewhere. Ideally, our alpha rhythm, for instance, is around 7 to 12 hertz or pulses per second. So you got a 60 hertz signal coming at you, which is an agitating signal for a person. And so these lower signals, if they're, you know, I mean, the Earth, as an example, has Schumann's resonance was discovered at 7.83 hertz, which is right in the alpha range, which is like the zone for intellectual work or for an artist or for an athlete. It's when you know, for all of us, we all reach that place where we go, aha, this is that spot, and where we're really effective in our creative and intellectual work. Then it just so happens to correlate to the natural oscillation of the Earth, yet we've surrounded ourselves with these higher oscillations that keep us in a constant state of stress.
So are you saying everything is in a frequency? So in other words, when you're talking about, oh, I hope I state this right, I guess I could say tempo, which, you know, that the frequency comes in to the brain, or, I mean, everything in the universe works at a frequency then, so...
Everything has its own pulse rate, absolutely, and the underlying motion of everything is the fact that we're not mostly solid, we're mostly not. And you know, you could look at it. Maybe this is a good picture too. Is maybe we're. I studied as a young person. First area of science was I got very interested in crystallography, and a crystal was always described as the outward expression of an object's internal arrangement of atoms by definition. But I always thought more about the idea than what does that make an atom when it's mostly just space. You know, it's really the outward expression of energy. And if you get down to a quantum level where, depending on the observer, the thing is either a particle or a wave, so it's either matter or it's not, and it's somehow interacting with you and I as a human being, that says, again, a lot about us as a human being and a quantum computer and a lot of other things, but it also says a lot about the nature of the reality. So, you know, this whole concept of energy as a weapon system, and that's where a lot of my work has been over the years, also sort of takes a person to this next place, which is everything that we think is important today in terms of weapon systems, which tear tissue and rip things and tanks and bullets and bombs, is going to be replaced by that which we do not see. The most important technologies of the 21st century are the ones we will not be able to perceive with our natural senses, only with instruments. And yet it will affect potentially our natural senses and our physiology. And this is what's so important, is we are in that revolution now, and we are going to change the very shape of everything we know in science because of this. And so this whole discussion about energy as it relates to matter, and I hear people misuse this concept of frequency all the time, but we're really talking about everything has its unique resonant vibrational note or tone, if you will. And it's true. It can be measured. It can, you know, you can know that absolutely.
Okay.
Wow.
When you get into the mind control, do you want to get into that a little bit on with this harp as far as...
On harp specifically, the biggest thing there is essentially, for instance, let me give you a good example, the earth-penetrating tomography that we were talking about earlier, this idea of looking into the earth several kilometers deep and imaging. Well, the frequency range that's used for that is between 1 and 20 hertz, or pulses per second, or vibrations per second. And what that means, when you look at analogy against the brain, the human brain in our deepest states of sleep, we're running about 1 to 4 hertz. It's a delta range. And then the theta range, which runs approximately 4 to 7 or 8 hertz, this is the range you are when you're sort of in that twilight state between awake and asleep. This is also the place that most, children under, say, between 2 and 5 spend most of their time, which is kind of a distinguishing reality from the imagination if you think about kids at that age. The next level is about 7 or 8 hertz to about 12 hertz. This is the alpha range, where we're in that sort of zone that I was talking about earlier. And then above that is beta, and most people, if we haven't put them to sleep tonight, are in that range now, and and maybe a little alpha mixing in, but that, you know, because we're actively thinking about what's being said and so on. You get higher in beta ranges and beyond, then you start getting agitated. So when you talk about earth-penetrating tomography, what we know is the brain locks onto these signals. So if you were innocently, for instance, doing an earth-penetrating tomography measure at, say, 20 hertz. You know, that's not the zone state or the focus state that you might want to be in. That's a lot slower. It tends to agitate. At the same time, maybe they go into that state. So you're in a state of focused concentration. Maybe that's a good thing. But the idea is it's being artificially driven. And these signals, depending on what's in your close proximity, you may lock on to those signals, and they figure about 70%. In terms of the literature, would in fact do that. So it would affect a huge segment of the population over a very broad area, even as a side effect. As a deliberate effect, it shows up all through the literature in terms of how you could use this signal. Nothing in the literature or in the open literature says HARP is going to be used for this. All we know is, yes, it can, and the Russians acknowledged it with their own technology. We blame them for this kind of thing back in the 70s. And we have a better technology today, and the only question is, are they using it for that? And that remains to be seen. Earth-penetrating tomography, they have used it, and these would be the side effects that you would expect to see.
If they're affecting human beings, how are they affecting the animals and the plants? Are the animals aggravated, too? Are the plants aggravated?
Well, again, everything has its own, resonant frequency or own relationship as a transducer. In fact, there was a study, when you bring this up, on microwaves in Europe, where the wavelength correlated to the needle length of a specific species of pine, and so the pine was getting wiped out, and they couldn't explain it. And it was weakening it, and then the beetles were killing it, and then they blamed the beetles. But what weakened beetles, in this cycle, were going after what was already weakened. And so they deduced that it was this relationship between the wavelength and the organic material. And in the case of HARP, you're dealing with focused energy going up, and depending on how that energy is coming back, we determine if there was a correlation with other living organisms and how that correlation would work. So you'd really need the science isn't advanced enough, I don't think, to give us a full view of what that damage might be. But what we do know in the science is enough to say, slow down, let's take a look before we start manipulating. Because HARP is essentially plugging in to the magnetic field lines of the Earth and manipulating it, or plugging into the ionosphere to manipulate it in a specific way to improve communications, to create this ground-penetrating tomography effect, and other reasons, and other purposes. And all of that is affecting a system that we've never been able to affect this way. And the other thing that's been found is that a small amount of energy into the ionosphere, in certain instances, when you hit its resonant frequencies or its sort of topover points, in one case they used very low frequency, VLF, pumped it into the ionosphere, and the signal that they got up there all of a sudden amplified by 1,000 times. So, you know, when you think about that, I mean, it was like the primer on a bullet. It went up there, and what it did is it triggered the natural system to release energy in a way that it normally would not have done. And that's where these systems get really exciting for the scientists, and higher risks for humanity when they're not being monitored. They're not in the open light of day. And when you start to think about these other applications or the other implications, when you again, you look across the disciplines. And we're very careful in our research. In 4 books, on the 3 that you named, and then the Controlling the Human Mind, which was released a couple years back, which actually was the last book we wrote. Between the 4, there are 1,650 source documents, all of which are academic studies, military reports, mainstream media, things that you can go and look up yourselves, not some anonymous conversation in the phone booth. And it's been our hallmark for the last 15 years because people, when we have that kind of information, we can use it. You know, all of us can, because then you can hand it to the expert and they can argue about the sources and hopefully they look them up and become advocates for change on these issues, because that's the only way these things change, is with good, solid information. Another reason why we stay away from certain issues, because they get so convoluted that they jeopardize the real mission, which is each of these issues is important, but the underlying rationale for why they're a risk, why they're important, is because the system isn't working very well. And that's maybe the deeper thing we need to address. Change the way in which science is viewed in the context of this century, in terms of liberty and freedom and democracies and republics, in terms of how we view the shaping of those technologies and how they affect our lives. Because right now they're just being driven by a market without much consideration for the human factor, as we now have witnessed in our banking industry and a few others recently.
Well, I found kind of interesting is you'd brought up one of the corporation's names and just how the a HAARP project itself had gone through various hands. And then, right. when you start going in and looking through these corporations, I mean, it's you get to the point where you can't – I mean, they're so globalized now that how in the world can they even be utilized as weapons for one side or the other, because the information is out there for everybody, in a sense.
Well, the thing about public corporations, essentially their reason to exist is to create a bottom line and to make money. So their, you know, the motivation is kind of greed design, you know. So the tempering of corporations has always been the struggle. In the past, it was royal families, you know. But I mean, moneyed interests versus the average person's interest, individual liberty, and the things that go with it. At the same time, the thing Eisenhower warned about really came to pass in a much more vigorous way than he could ever have imagined. When you consider the power of corporations, some of them overwhelming even most governments of the world in terms of their economic power, yet they have no tie to anyone. I mean, Halliburton's a good example today that we, you know, we hear a lot about. What, you know, as the Bush administration goes out and Cheney gives his farewell, people need to remember that he was the one who convened all those energy meetings that led to the energy policy that got us where we are, an energy policy that just bankrupted the United States in terms of a whole lot of people. $2 billion are being talked about, almost a trillion, thrown in by the Republicans, now another trillion to come by the Democrats in a different direction. But the point is, the mess was created by greed, by a view of the world that said, let's figure out how to use government, not to enhance the lives of individuals, but how to enhance the pocketbooks of corporate officers who are motivated by things that aren't in the public interest. And well, that's the problem, is that kind of coupling of moneyed interest to public policy, to a military establishment that fuels most of that economic engine. And now a $1 trillion bank bailout, which is a whole lot better than the military, I can tell you, and a construction bailout, But when you look at all that, the I guess the corruption factor needs to be looked at a little more vigorously in terms of how those organizations have any interaction with the federal government. You know, the government is, you know, of the people, by the people, not corporations. And this is where this science, now today, where science is such a threat to people, we need to rein in corporations' influence over government, because that's where it starts and that's where it ends. It's in public policy and the way we implement our public policy. And, well, and we've forgotten that. We've just gotten lost in the show.
Well, that's where your public-private partnership ends up being, you know, I mean, it is kind of a fascistic situation, but what you were talking about with Cheney and that sort, I mean, then it appears that it didn't, what's going on didn't really happen by accident.
No.
No, it was.
No, and Cheney got, you know, Cheney's Halliburton, you know, they moved their corporate office out of Houston into Dubai because, you know, you can't subpoena those papers anymore. You can't, and then you can't subpoena the information. You can't extradite those guys that are guilty, that are working over there. So, you know, they started doing that over a year ago when it hit the press. So you have, you can't even go back and find out what they stole or what they did. And, you know, when you look at Halliburton with 50% overhead costs in Iraq, you know, there's a whole lot of things that need to be scrutinized after the looting is taking place. In a war that lasted longer than World War II and spent more of the national wealth than anything we've seen since, it took us from the black for the first time in decades to the biggest red that we've ever seen from a party that says they're conservative on spending. You know, we're in trouble, and it's because of corporations. And now we look at technologies as being part of that sort of quiver of tools. And no, I don't think there's any accidents. But at the same time, I don't think there's some grand scheme, but I think people tend to express themselves in a way that lines up with, and again, getting back to that sort of pre-show conversation, your basic spiritual nature. And I think we've been running in a direction, not entirely in the wrong direction, but maybe not realizing the implications of our creativity as human beings. And I think that's going to be a big part of what happens in this century. I really am encouraged in one sense. I mean, the bad news, you know, even in this economy, you know, as people are suffering across the country, it's in suffering, unfortunately, it's one of the very few times that we as people have enough sort of reflection and time to reflect on what the heck got us here. And then we tend to be a little bit more active on how we're getting out. And that, I think, is long overdue. You know, we've been asleep for a very, very long time.
And what are your recommendations for us getting out of it?
Well, I think we stay politically engaged. You know, whether we believe that this is the this established government that we've just reconstituted in the country is going to be the one, I think we got to stay engaged. In fact, my brother just went to the U.S. Senate. He just got elected here in Alaska.
So they did get that settled.
The longest-serving Republican in the Republican Party's history in the Senate. You know, there are people moving along that are going to be listening in a different way. And I think the implications of this last year now with the economy, you know, there is an opportunity. And I think it really is an opportunity to fix some things. I think at the same time, it's time to watch out for the exploitations going along with it, because it's just going to be a different group of people benefiting. And we want to make sure that ultimately a greater benefit falls to the American people this time. And, you know, and as we impact the rest of the world, we all need to be rethinking it. The science of today is going to destroy us, or it's going to create a very different kind of society. And we're at the cusp. I mean, we are at a point where we can sort of drift along, or we can engage and start to think about the fact that we are a wealthy, wealthy nation. I'll give you a good example. You know, people are all, you know, we're all worried about the dollar. We're all worried about this stuff. The Bush administration assessed the oil and gas resources of Alaska, as an example. And in the northern regions of Alaska and the coastal regions of Alaska, and if you look at the oil basins in Alaska, you'll discover that about a third of this state is oil and gas basins and mineral wealth and coal. And half of the public lands in the United States are in Alaska that are remaining public. And just the oil and gas on the north slope of Alaska, by some, is projected to be as valuable as $36 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars. And that's a national resource owned in common by all of us. That is triple the current portion of the national debt and a major chunk of the Social Security obligation into the future. So when you start to think about, again, national wealth and what it represents, and then who's hijacking it, we need to stop the bleed long enough to readdress where we are as a nation for a lot of different reasons. And technology has been sort of my backdrop for a lot of it, because I see it as the biggest threat to curtailing personal privacy, to curtailing the voting privilege by electronic voting, which can screw everything up and make it a total sham. And in many places, I think some of us are believing that's the case. You know, but when you start to look at the whole picture, we're in that last sort of phase. The next 7-10 years are going to determine a lot about, maybe even shorter, about sort of where we head in, as a general direction. So it becomes even more important to get a different generation of thinkers in our Congress, because, you know, seniority is a bad idea in this day and age for a lot of reasons. Seniority, having 85 and 90-year-old legislators, and, you know, God bless them for being there and serving that long. But things change so dramatically, and their ability to keep up, much less with all the issues that they have to legislate, becomes increasingly difficult. And so you get, you know, we're missing some generational knowledge in the Congress, and certainly science knowledge, which is the biggest driver between, look at who's powerful on the planet today, who are the big threats on the planet today, and it is only those who command and control high technologies for the most part. And the rest is manipulating those technologies in very small terrorist kind of activities. But on the big scale, it's science that drives it. How many scientists do we have in our Congress in any field? Very, very, very few. And that's the problem when so much is driven by. Look at the senior senator from Alaska who thought the internet was pipes and tubes, was chairing you know, commerce, science, and transportation at one point, technology chair. You know, I mean, come on. You know, the guy didn't have the basic knowledge that's needed to regulate, much less legislate, the way in which it's going to look for all of us. And that's a big problem politically, is we need more science consideration in how we sort of develop public policy. We have less corporate interest, and we need to start assessing the national treasure. Because you know how we hear about taking care of the national debt generally is, well, how are we going to raise taxes, or, you know, what are we going to do to the taxpayer? As if that's the only asset, as if we are an asset to the country, is our ability to generate income and pay them taxes. There are other assets that the country has, and we need to take stock of how those assets are being managed, whether they're, you know, because the same thing has happened historically is happening now. They're being hijacked for very little. A good example, we have a mineral deposit in Alaska that generated over $1 billion profit and left less than 5% in state and local taxes. You know, that you pay more than that in your Social Security contribution on your payroll check. There's a very big disconnect in terms of policy towards the national wealth, because corporations have been able to make sure of it. And we need to reassess. All of this needs a reassessment. And maybe this is the beginning of it. You know, I hope it is with this change in administration, and we'll see. We got to stay diligent.
Would you talk a bit about the state of democracy in the 21st century and your Earth Rising 2, the betrayal of science, society, and the soul?
Yeah.
You talked a tad about what that looks like. Would you tell us about it?
Well, you know, I think on a lot of levels, you know, and since we published that now 6 years ago, you know, that was 2002, and it just followed 9/11. And, you know, the sort of the first volume of that was in 2000 that Jim and I wrote, and it was sort of looking at all this science. And he and I were, you know, sat in the office here for, you know, years building that database to put that book together. And when we looked at it, we said, you know, this has got to be a warning. You know, I mean, if you look at this in the whole sense, and then afterwards, because we, they projected, I mean, the military literature literally suggested that the best way to usher in this whole regime of technology was to create an environment of fear and panic predicated on international terrorism and drug trafficking. And they did this at the U.S. Army War College in 1989 in a paper that was The Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, which if you go back and you do a search on RMA or the last Secretary of Defense, and Cheney, you're going to find Rumsfeld and Cheney's hands all over it, because they grabbed that concept. And it was this idea that you create enough anxiety in the population, they'll look the other way. Well, you hijack every civil liberty that's left, and then you've got a fully transparent society, and you can have the absolute insulated police state according to your values and your laws. And that's fine in a benevolent, holistic, you know, view of the world, but we don't have that. We have a sinister group of people who view themselves as righteous enough to dictate to the rest of us how we should live. And whether it's Democrats or Republicans or something in between, too many of those folks have lost sight of the fact that self-determination starts with an individual. and that's what it's about, as long as, you know, and that self-determination says a government stays out of our lives to the greatest extent possible, that we are free thinkers, that we can think and say whatever we want within the context of our private lives, and that is about to change. And I think that's a very big issue, should be the one of the biggest issues on the planet is, should that change? And to what degree are we going to make ourselves transparent in exchange for security and safety in the 21st century? Cool. And at the same time, you know, what are the implications of these changes? You know, I mean, as we become increasingly transparent, who's going to establish what is the norm? What is the value system? What is appropriate for each of us to be doing, and then legislating it, as so much of our legislation does today?
Well, our children are already being infiltrated in regard to, like, GPSs and such, and being
sure.
able to locate it at a moment's notice, and then feeling secure with that versus...
Right, and we wrote about this long before it ever became an issue, and said the same things, is it looks good. You know, but now all your cars, it has it built in. Your cell phones, it's built in by law. Your ability to maintain privacy is being not necessarily taken immediately, but it's being set up to be taken from you, in the sense that all these technologies in the right conditions serve that capacity. I mean, all the cameras that are on the planet eventually become networked. All of the cell phones, people say, well, you know, cell phones can actually be activated and used as a microphone, you know, and a locator device. It's been done. People say, well, we take the battery out, and they can't do it. Well, there's something called magnetic induction, which has been perfected in the last couple of years. That'll let you at least broadcast energy at low densities a pretty good distance, so you can actually pull your battery out, and you can still get the phone activated at a distance.
Where do these Gwyn
take? You know, there's a lot of ways to the finish line in terms of technology, but the thing that's happened is it's become sort of, it used to be privacy, and the way most of the case law read, privacy started and ended is sort of at your front door, you know, of your house. Mm-hmm. Today, your greater aspect of privacy is your digital doorway, the information about you stored somewhere. And that's what needs to be protected as vigorously as your front door, because it is the gateway to you as an individual, your patterns as an individual, which allows marketers, politicians, government, or whoever, to just sort of pitch you the ideas you're going to agree with and ignore all the others, to manipulate you in ways that are grossly unfair because of the advantage they hold by controlling your information. You never know what their true intention is because it's always manipulated based on the data they have available to know how to get you to say whatever it is they want you to say. And that's the danger in all of this. A transparent society is healthy in certain respects, but as it relates to personal privacy, transparency should go up. You know, we should have transparent governments and opaque individuals if we really value privacy. So we could see our government, make sure it was honest. When you want to put cameras somewhere, put them in all government offices and see what we're paying these people for. You know?
I mean, good idea.
You know, I mean, why not? I mean, why not? Anybody, nobody's talking about that because there's too many congressmen say the conversation happened in my office need to be secret. Well, then whose business are you doing? The people's business or someone else's? Because, you know, these are reasonable concepts that people should be raising. And, you know, how much transparency in government do we deserve in the 21st century? Because technology can support it. And certainly there's times when people need to negotiate their politics in private to come up with something, perhaps. But those should be very rare instances, very, very rare instances. And in terms of public policy that affects our lives, maybe they shouldn't happen at all.
I need to do a station ID here. And you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you'd like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And I'm talking here with my co-host Katie and Dr. Nick Begich. Okay. Are you familiar with the Gwyn Towers?
Right. The ground wave emergency system. And, you know, this was, again, you know, it's another system of essentially using a way to overcome a nuclear attack was the way this was originally designed. So we have a system in place that could still communicate, keep communications alive. And there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, maybe this is a mind control project as well. And again, what I want to emphasize is any electromagnetic carrier can be used to manipulate brain activity. And there's a really excellent article. It's called The Mind Has No Firewalls. It's published by the U.S. Army War College in their quarterly called Perimeters back in, I believe it was winter 98. We quoted in the book Controlling the Human Mind, which is really, if people are interested in that subject, it is an important work. It really breaks down the details of these issues. It really talks a lot about sort of the evolution of the science. It goes back to the 1800s when hypnosis was first being really actively pursued, up into the labs of Harvard in the 20s, and then carrying on basically up until 2005, I think, was the last reference we used. But when you start to think about the most important area that we've covered, it's probably probably this whole area of mind control or mind effects. In fact, we did a conference on the subject when I was the executive director for the Lay Institute on Technology, which I did for 4 years. Their executive director based in Dallas, and you can check their site out. But there's a number of video clips of the participants, which included Garth Nicholson, who many remember from the Gulf War testimony he gave in the Congress back in the 90s. A very interesting guy. We had Elizabeth Rauscher there. We had Bernard Eastland there. We had Alexander K. Varanen, who used to be the former biophysics lab director for the former Soviet Union for the 10 years prior to them collapsing. Brilliant. We had Anu Mikaela and her husband, their electrophysiologist from Finland, and it was an incredible conference, and there's a lot of material on that website, layinstitute.org, and it's free. I think there's like 10 hours of video available there that's free on
okay,
that conference.
I heard you discuss that on the Alex Jones interview that was posted on the Internet, and so that's where that interview is at. I was wondering where it
right.
was.
Right, and I think we have it all mirrored also on our earthpulse.com, EARTHPULSE, or pulse.com. And there's a lot of articles, a lot of information on the subject. But the biggest thing about this whole area is, I mean, if the mind of individuals is not sacred, if you think about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, all those basic freedoms that we have, they're all predicated on the first concept that our founding fathers never imagined, but freedom to think, freedom to feel the emotions that you naturally emerge from you. You know, I had a guy hit me in a lecture once and say, wouldn't it be great if we could just make everybody happy? And I said, no. And, and we all have experienced the whole swing of human emotions. The reason we have all those emotions is because that's what makes us human. And more than that, I think in the hardest of times is where we really learn the most about our character, about our ability to overcome. I mean, if any of us have any gray hair out there and we all can think about it, it's in the hard times that we learn the most and the greatest opportunities present themselves. And also in those very few times of pure love, when you romantic love, when you first meet that person. I mean, those periods of life that happen, those are about the only other emotional times where real change is possible. And so, you know, we kind of learn it the hard way. And the thing about technology today is we don't have time to sort of reflect. We have to think in advance of where the technology is going and then start legislating up front. And we're not doing that yet. And that's a huge handicap. And so when Jim and I wrote our material and we started looking forward to the future, it wasn't a good future unless people would engage. And I think we saw, from 2002, sort of the afterburners was, okay, now we're in for it. You know, we watched all these homeland security laws get passed and our personal privacy evaporate, telephone companies installing equipment. Here's a good example is digital storage is so efficient now that you could literally store every digital communication for, very little money. And in a lot of cases, we're already doing that. And so what happens is you don't have a warrant for the data, but you can still store it. It's just a matter of looking at it. So then you get the warrant. Now you can go back in history and get every digital connection that you've got in life. And this is how it's done today. And we've reported on this for years. But the implications of that aren't really understood. What that means is that today's government that you might like maybe won't do that. But tomorrow's government that you might not like so much, they'll exploit that. And we just saw it in the Bush administration that's fortunately leaving in a few days. I hope we don't see it in the next one. I hope we see the dismantling of it and the full disclosure, the public disclosure of what was done to us, more importantly. And I don't know that we're going to see that. I think there's this sense of, let's just move on. And sometimes it's good to find out what happened to us so when we move on, we reform the union in a way that really supports individuals again and not corporations and not big interests and not the kinds of things that led us down this path.
I did an interview with Dr. Truott, and he'd gotten into a little bit on, he'd written an article called The Sounds of Silence. Are you familiar with that? Okay. Do you subscribe to what he, his theory there, or I guess it's facts,
I was, he was talking about the silent sound spread spectrum, the SSSS is what he called it, and he was suggesting it was used in Kuwait and Iraq during the Gulf War. I just did an hour radio on another network on this very subject earlier today, and the thing that happens is you get these internet things, and this is like a one-pager that's floated around the internet, analog to digital, and we talked about this 8 years ago in the context of like 50 other issues. And what we said, number one, was what it is it's a matter of data density. On a high density, you get more information across to the individual, and you can do a lot more with it. So, yes, a lot of the things that are being asserted about high definition being more useful for affecting people's psychology, as an example, or for sending other information in or collecting information out on these kinds of digital systems. Ultimately, where we're headed is sort of two-way telecommunications, where our what we consider our TVs become more than that. They become our computer, our TV, our burglar alarm system because they look both ways, and then we just trust the system to not turn the switch on like kids trust GPS to be a good thing for them today. I mean, it's that kind of gradual sort of conditioning that comes in. But, when I look at high definition as a big conspiracy, there's a couple parts of it. First of all, it was a good way to squeeze out a lot of small communications companies that couldn't handle the conversions. So they had to give up and sell out to the big conglomerates, which ultimately has been sort of one of the other legacies of deregulation is a more controlled and narrow media where there's less and less independent outlets. The other side of this, and these are all economic considerations, and the other consideration is, of course, could they use this in other ways, and that's what the assertion is, and the article is sort of the letter of statements floating around the internet, and the answer is yes, but any system can. It just happens high definition gives you more data density, so yes, it can be better than analog. Was it a grand conspiracy? Who knows? When you got corporations pushing the buttons, and they certainly created a whole industry. I mean, everybody's throwing away TVs. I mean, if you're in the TV business, you're making some money the last few years. At least you had the potential to. At the same time, when you look at the telecommunications legislation that passed in a couple of big chunks over the last 20 years, it really created a consolidated industry. Now, would government fund this because a bunch of lobbyists got together and just fund $8 billion? You know, that's eight, you know, what is that, eight bombers? You know, I mean, it's nothing in the big scope of federal, you know, corporate corruption. I mean, that's not a big number. From my perspective, it is a big number, and for everyone else's too. But are they doing it for some sinister purpose? Maybe, but I don't think the politicians are out there mapping some plan. Certainly, the technology will be misused, and I think that's the bigger point. Once technology is available, the tendency is to misuse it unless there's some specific way that you guard against it. And that, I don't care whether they're Republicans or Democrats, the temptation. In fact, there's a great book by a guy that actually said it, and it was Between Two Ages.
I was going to ask
American
you about
role
that one.
In the Electronic Era by Zbigniew Brzezinski, and paraphrasing, that's essentially what he said is, doesn't matter who's in control. You know, one will do it for one set of rational reasons, the other will do it for another set of rational reasons. They'll both miss the point. Tampering with the human mind maybe is off limits. And some of these other areas where technology might give them some advantage politically or otherwise to further their political ends, the temptation is what has to be resisted by law. And the implications of misusing this technology have to have severe and swift consequences. And we don't have any body of law protecting us from these technologies. And it so it becomes, as an example, in people studying psychology today in school, they understand frequency following response. It's taught. And so if you apply that to advertising, all you have to do is make sure the flicker rate that's maintained through the ad is such that you fall into that sort of accepting, almost trance-like state as they deliver the normal sales slogan, and you absorb it as if it's the truth, because most of us don't discriminate much. And at the end of the day, people are tired and they're worn out and they sit down and they're already in a state where the mind is easily entrained. And so just applying that knowledge in advertising construct, that's the outcome you get. You get
you're showing a subliminal or two.
And there's no law against it.
And how does that affect human health in general?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about... it depends on the situation because, as we said earlier in the program, I'll give you a good example. And it was Becker who did some really good work. He wrote The Body Electric was one of his books, and he wrote a number of others. And he's really a brilliant guy. And he gave a good example in one of his, and it was this idea that iodine, all of us have a certain amount of iodine in the body. But if I broadcast a signal in that resonates with iodine, that harmonizes with iodine in terms of its resonant frequency, what ends up happening is the body believes all of a sudden it just got a massive dose of iodine and it begins to exhibit all the physical symptoms, except when you do the blood work and check the thyroid, the iodine levels appear normal. And so it's classified as a mystery illness. Well, so you can trick the body with these signals, but they have to be exact, precision. You have to know something, or they have to be accidentally applied. And today, a lot of that's going on. I think we're going to find, and I know we're going to find, and I've said it before, is as time moves on, we're going to discover the interactions between energy and chemistry is such that we've really created more of a complex environmental soup than we originally thought. When you consider some of the chemical hazards that have been identified. In fact, I had this discussion with some folks. They wrote a book on the subject. One was Nicholas Ashford and Theo Colburn. And they one was from MIT, I forget the university the other was from. But the discussion was about chemicals that created false hormones in the environment. And what it did is create a situation where the species were being observed to become more and more feminized, where less and less productive in terms of reproduction. And this showed up first in Arctic climates, and then they did some work in Denmark, showed that it was affecting human population. They traced it back to chemicals in the environment. And what I said to those guys, I said, what about energy interactions with those chemicals along the same principle that I'm talking about, Becker's principle of resonance? And I remember Professor Ashford raising his hands and waving them and saying, Nick, it's tough enough just to get people to understand the chemistry. You throw this in the mix, and it's just more difficult for people to understand because they can't see it. It's energy. They can't understand it. We talk about it loosely. People call it frequency without understanding what that really means. It's about resonance. It's about transducing energy from one form to another. It's what we as humans do. It's what everything does on one level or another. And yet, it's so fundamental But if you can influence that, you influence everything that springs from it, which is us. And when I was giving earlier that analogy of the crystal, outward expression of the internal arrangement of atoms, but those atoms are the outward expression, the internal arrangement of energy, and that is who we are. And so when you think of energy technologies and just the energies that we surround ourselves with, those relationships are being discovered, and their complexities are being discovered. And there's enough in literature to say, slow it down. And in, as an example, in the former Soviet Union, now that's over, 18 years ago that that place folded up, 20 years ago at most, and in terms of the old regime. And yet their electromagnetic exposure regulations were 1,000 times more strict than those in the United States, because they had discovered that these subtle relationships, this resonance relationship between energy and matter, could change matter and therefore change living organisms. And so, yes, all these things can, but it's either done randomly and by mistake as an accident, big mass accident, or with those with sophisticated knowledge, this can be very deliberate in a way that affects our physiology in a profound way.
So they do have the technology currently.
Absolutely.
But we are not really sure of how they're using it at this point.
Absolutely.
How much they're using it.
And that's exactly it. The science in these areas has been advancing dramatically over the last 50 years. And electrophysiology as a science, I mean, Jose Delgado, who I mentioned earlier, got his degree in electrophysiology in 1950. From the University of Madrid. These concepts and these ideas have been explored for decades and even centuries when you consider some of the first experiments with electricity and frog muscles contracting. You know, I mean, these are things that have been looked at and pondered and are becoming understood in this last couple of decades, to the point where now we're sophisticated enough to start manipulating them in much more profound ways than we could in the past. And this is, these areas are all areas that we've researched. And what we find is there's a tremendous amount of material that is in the public record that pretty well lays out the foundation. And that's what all of our published work has done. That's why I like the books. You know, people keep getting away from printed matter, but the books give you the footnotes, the material, so you can say, okay, where did this come from? And, can I validate the data? And that's important, because these are concepts that will change our lives. And, you know, we say to people, you know, a lot of people, you know, jump quickly to make change in life when they hear somebody that's supposed to be an expert. What I say to people is, go look up some of the material first. Don't change anything unless you can document the material. I mean, why would you change your life for somebody else's idea unless you absolutely could confirm it? And I encourage people to do that in these areas, because they are important. And once we engage a rational debate, perhaps some of these ideas can be reformed in a way that more serves our interest rather than works against us.
Well, that should be good in politics, too.
Well, you know, that's sort of the crossover. You know, I like the science, the family history, and politics is important, because I really believe, and I was taught to believe, that, you know, at the root of all change is what we individually, you know, do within that political arena, and on a spiritual level as well. I mean, because that's what should drive our politics and our existence and how we interact with each other in the world. And whether you call it the politics of it, you know, you hear about that office politics, you know, your politics at home. The fact is, it's about relationships and how we decide to relate to one another, and how we decide our technology should serve the enhancement of those relationships, so that we can have a free an independent society that allows us to actualize our potentials. And that's how our society should operate today. I mean, we have the ability that we can see people self-actualized in a way that we never could before, but we don't have enough focus on the fact that individual self-determination is where good democratic republics are built. It's by a strong individual within our societies that we have the opportunity to overcome our obstacles. And we've forgotten that. And so the government has begun to look at us as just sort of taxpayers. Others look at us as just the market, you know, the consumer. But we're human beings, which entails much, much more than the things we do, like paying taxes and consuming things. And that's what we have to get back to. And our government should reflect that. And our institutions should reflect that. And for most part, many of those institutions have forgotten it.
Well, I guess I was meaning that more in the fact that instead of just listening to somebody else and what we should be doing, we should have a little bit more background on why we make the decisions that we make. I heard somebody recently say on a radio program that, you know, it was the kings and the priests that, you know, spoke of the religion and politics, and it makes you wonder why those two subjects are not supposedly politically correct. So,
well, I think things go in swings. I mean, right now people are contemplating a whole lot more than they were, you know, what's important to them. And because we've seen some pretty big disruptions in virtually touched everybody's lives in some way or another. You know, here in Alaska, it's a little odd. You know, we're kind of insulated from the rest of the world's economy. We actually have a flat real estate market, but our values are on a par with last year and the year before. And, you know, when you look at our economy here, we have a lot of rural unemployment, but in the urban areas, things are pretty stable. But it's unique. When I think about the rest of the country and what most people are experiencing right now, you know, 401ks, retirement plans, Social Security, all the things that people thought were there are not there today. It sort of makes us ask the question of, you know, what happened to get us to this point? And that's where the full exploration sort of brings us back full circle. You know, the last time this happened was the last time, you know, when you think about the history of the Congress, the political parties used to be just based on kind of simple things. And the Democrats were sort of the people's party, the average working person's party, and the Republicans were the guys for the big rich guys. And then what happened in the 1970s is both parties sort of realized they couldn't maintain the constituencies in that way. One was the ad hoc Democrats, early 70s, changed that into a different kind of party, which became more of a liberal party. The Republicans sort of seized on that, figured, okay, what constituency bases work hard, do things, and they sort of grabbed the Republican right, or the religious right, as it's referred to today, only to discover that they had been used by commercial interest, really to further commercial ends. It had nothing to do with religion. It had to do with votes and Senate seats. And I think the realization of all that will dawn on people as we sort of walk through the period of suffering that so many are going through right now. And in that, we sort of reflect on what do these parties really represent to us. And it's not, and the parties, you know, you look at who contributes to the political parties, because you can contribute to the party almost endlessly. You can give them as much money as you want. So the big corporations give them money, and then the party leadership goes out and recruits the candidates, which is a very important function. But when you have corporations sort of picking the party leadership and the party leadership picking the candidates, you end up with candidates that are sort of just part of the same swill of problems. And that's sort of one of the fallacies that people don't really see is very, very few truly independent within the political parties emerge where they have enough power to get elected because of the way in which candidates are elected. So the mediocre, in many cases, are the preferred candidates of the establishment because they'll do what they're told. They don't think for themselves. And you can think about it in terms of your local politics, particularly where you see a lot of that manifest. And not that there's not bright people, but those bright people tend to already be ideologically aligned with those people paying their bills. And so the scrutiny of government needs to happen a lot differently. We need to start asking ourselves the question again is, who are the individuals that represent us best, and then hold their feet to the fire and see if they can perform. And I think that's the only way we kind of work our way through it. And then reform the political parties, which is going to be the bigger challenge for them to reform themselves and get their parties back to where the average person is really doing something. And that whole system maybe is even no longer effective. Maybe there needs to be something else.
Yeah, and where do you see that whole system supporting or not supporting the radio frequency IDs?
Well, that's a big deal. I mean, that's a really big, important issue. You know, when you think about identification of virtually everything on a radio, you're talking about the RFIDs. And again, we talked about this in Earth Rising Revolution of 2000. That whole trend is essentially going to embed everything. You'll be able to the IRS, for instance, will be able to walk into your house, wave a device, and have a complete inventory of everything you have. and how much it costs.
Ooh,
or how much it's worth.
I never even thought of it that way.
Excuse me?
I never thought of it that way.
And no, exactly. You see, the difference between RFID tags, like if a barcode, you see a barcode on a book, it says that this is book A, and that it doesn't tell you this is book one of book A and book two of book A. In other words, not uniquely serialized, just generally categorized. RFID is uniquely serialized, which means this is the item that Joe Smith bought on his credit card from the 7-Eleven on Thursday last week at 6 a.m. You know, that's the kind of data that you track with RFID. And that supplier bought it from Joe Smith, distributing company, a day before for, you know, I mean, this is how the data string goes when you have RFID. Every movement of that item through its life goes on. Now, think about your currency having RFID, which is another thing that will be coming. Stay tuned. It's not too far off. So when you go to the bank and you get your money, exactly every nickel, virtually every dollar is tracked in a manner. So you go to the garage sale, the guy better report the income, you know, because when he goes to spend that dollar, how did the dollar get from A to B? Well, where's my piece, you know, the government carving its piece? And probably the tax system will change to where they'll carve the piece on transaction. It'll be a value-added tax like what they have in Europe and in most of the rest of the world. We don't have that here yet. We hear a lot of discussion about it. Sales taxes, we commonly call it in the U.S. So then they get their money every time you register the transaction. So there's lots of things and implications to RFID that aren't being considered. Now, the other thing that people don't consider, and they used to say, well, RFID, you have to be really close to read it. That's not true. And we said it years ago that there's magnetic induction that allows you to activate the RFID from a distance and to read from a distance. And now in the last year, we've seen press reports say you can read an RFID with the new technology up to a kilometer away. So, you know, the guy who's going to decide who he's going to rob walking down the street when everybody's money is tagged in this manner can go, well, that's the guy with the most money, and not waste their time with the other guy. You know, and this is the kind of stuff that we have to contemplate as time goes on. This might sound good, but wait a minute. Maybe a certain amount of anonymity is just the cost of a democratic republic. Not everything has to be quite so visible.
Go ahead.
The only thing you couldn't tag is like gasoline, but the way they want to overcome that is they want to tax you by the mile because of electric cars. Instead of, and with GPS, they can tax you by the mile. They tried this in one state as a sort of a trial run, and it was so, you know, strongly resisted as a concept, never made it. But it's going to change because people are going to say, well, I'm buying gas and I'm paying for the road tax, and these guys are riding for free. And so there you have it. That will be the next thing. And we're going to see it. And it, none of this is like by accident. It's just because marketing people are going to spend billions on new concepts, spend billions to figure out how to sell them to you. And that's very important for you to remember. It's about selling to you. And this is what's wrong with a lot of this, is because that becomes more manipulative and less persuasive, because now it's about the information once again. They only give you what they know you're likely to respond favorably to. And they don't give you full information. And then full information is denied by manipulating the data wherever they can get away with it. And they, in the general sense, because, you know, people work in their own self-interest. And, you know, that's why it's important to always ask, where did the information come from, before you jump to the conclusion of what one must do.
There have already been U.S. citizens that have had identification tags put in their bodies so they can be found. Where do you see that going?
Well, and you know, already in Mexico, the Attorney General's office, several hundred employees were given RFIDs under the skin. Heads of state around the world, this is done. Special forces, this is done, because now these are much more sophisticated than RFID. They're actually microcircuits with a lot of capabilities, so you can tell stress levels, you can tell a lot of physiological factors about an individual with these implants. And not only where they are and, you know, what their stress level is. So if you think about special forces in the battlefield, you can locate with GPS now, with these circuits built into the body, where all your troops are precisely and where all your equipment is precisely. Now, if you were going into combat, you might want that. In fact, it came up in that publication, Revolution, Military Affairs, and Conflict, Short of War from 1989, U.S. Army War College. And they said, you know, and in that article said, you know, we could use this in special forces, and now they are. So we could use this in business travelers, although we wouldn't activate it because, you know, we wouldn't do such a thing unless there was an emergency, but then we could find everybody. Well, there you go. There you go again. Do you trust our government to not turn the switch on? I don't, and I never will, because my family's been in government two generations at the national and state and local level, and I can tell you government is only trustworthy if you stay on government and keep it trustworthy. It is not by its own design, and it will never be. It requires a vigilant, aggressive population to keep it honest, and that's the way the country was designed. We can't passively just allow it to sort of drift along. We have to engage the political process to some degree. And that collective idea was that between all of us as individuals doing it to just some degree, it would be enough to keep a few hundred guys honest. And we just need to do it. And we just need to do it as part of our responsibility as Americans, something not taught to kids these days. In fact, maybe indoctrinated out of kids early on.
That RFID could be a two-edged sword, too, because your criminals can have those readers, too.
Absolutely, and this is the point. Now let's look at this again in a different way. And the way they're selling it to us, by the way, is, you know, your elders who are losing mental faculties so they don't get lost, and your children, so they're playing on our fears again. Well, we managed for many thousands of years as human beings without that. And we did okay, and I think we're doing okay. And every once in a while, in a planet of a few billion people, somebody gets lost, and you know maybe we need to do some things there. But those are individual choices, not government requirements. And this is the problem with all of this: it shifts to a government requirement. And you know, some have said, well, why don't we RFID or chip in a way with GPS capability, habitual criminals? Well, you know, society, I suppose, could do that. But again, in that case, we are penalizing someone who has done something which deserves a penalty. We're not penalizing the general public because there's bad people in the population. And this is where I think that would be appropriate, you know, if that was what we decided and made laws to do that. But when it comes to the average person, too much of the time we say, well, 1% of the people are these horrible criminals, so let's take care of the other 99 so we can find that one. Well, we don't operate that way, and that is not the way that a 21st century society should operate either, because that implies guilt by everyone, and that's not how we operate. It just is, it's the wrong way to think about people as basically criminals. Segregate those that are truly criminals, penalize them in an appropriate way, and restrict them from being able to access society until they can access society in an appropriate manner. And if not, you know, I don't have a problem chipping those guys to know where they've been and what they've been doing until such time as they're serve their time or change their behaviors.
Well, those ankle bracelets and that sort are that in a way, aren't they not?
Sure. Right. That's exactly it.
Okay.
Exactly it. And all we're talking about is a microcircuit, you know, and there's, you know, and we have to ask the implications of all that. And again, here's why I say we have to be careful in this area, even with criminals. Because when you get a leader, like, you know, nobody expected Adolf Hitler to arrive, but when he did, he sure would have exploited that, you know, in terms of who's the criminal. And, you know, and again, these are things that have implications that we have to consider. They also have utility that we have to consider, but balancing that utility against the things that are fundamental need to be put back into sort of the curriculum, but in the context of this century. So people start thinking about this. I mean, children in school, even when I was in school, were taught very little about how to participate in government. We were given a lot of information about government, but we were not given the information that would make us as engaging. And in my generation, we still had some of it. But today, they have very little of that. In some places, you might see little squirts of it. But as institutions, to make sure that we're equipping people to be responsible individuals who are supposed to be directing the government and understand that and aren't just the victims of the government, which is how most sort of children look at government as a suppressive thing that comes at them, because it does. We need to get that flip back around and put the back perspective, and that's not going to be done overnight. And
isn't that
suffering, we sort of learn our way back to that, and I think that's where the country is maybe headed.
Don't you think a little bit of that is by design as well?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, look at how, here's the thing, look at the textbook industry. and look at the money attached. If anybody's bought a textbook lately, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, because you're paying a fortune for each one of those books. And you look at how they're tied and how much public money and how the whole game is played for how curriculum is adopted. And then you look at the interlocking boards of directors of who owns those publishing companies and what other boards those same board members serve on. And you start to look at the whole picture, and you're dealing with the same people in terms of, you know, what a great plan. You know, you catch them early, make sure they're getting the information the way you want it, neutralizing the spark out of anyone that might oppose you, and you're making people into a consumer set and a bunch of factory workers when you really want self-actualized individuals that reach their whole and full potential, whatever that is. And it varies with every one of us. But that, you know, when you think about public education, that should be its goal. You know, I mean, and we certainly have the ability to do it, and we certainly spend enough money on it, but it's not. And again, when money gets tight, things get tough, people start to struggle, sort of reevaluate, hey, how are our institutions that we built, how are they working, are they working, are things getting fixed, or are we getting into a situation where we're worse off than we were before? And not in just an economic sense, but fundamentally, where we're really worse off is we don't have an engaged public that is self-determining, because we become dependents. We used to be, 50 years ago, most individuals could figure out how to survive fairly well with a good expectation of doing it. Whether you were in the trades or in the professions, you could expect to own a home, you could expect to go send your kids to college, you could expect to do a lot of things. Today, those expectations are gone for most people. And it's not for a shortage of resources. It's just in which, it's just the way in which we've allowed sort of things to happen. We've changed our focus. We're supposed to get a peace dividend after the Soviet Union fell, and instead we just had to create new villains. We're spending more on weapons and war than we ever spent before, and the United States is carrying the load for the rest of the world, and the American public is paying for it. Let me give you the contrast. In this society, we built debt. So people have credit cards and mortgages and bank accounts and all this stuff. In the Soviet Union or in China, the average person doesn't have a credit card. The average person doesn't have a mortgage. They actually own their homes. When they say, I own my house, that means nobody else shares it with them in terms of the payment. They actually have it. And because of that, where our mortgage industry and our banking is collapsing in this country because of our debt, they're still thriving because they pay cash. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a whole different way of looking at the world. And yet, even in the last, the ones that are suffering are the wealthy in these countries. I mean, the ultra-wealthy that are holding financial instruments where they've had to invest their money in stock markets and things like this. But the average person in these countries, they don't do that. They don't have that kind of disposable income. They keep the cash under the mattress because they've experienced all the bad news. In Russia, they keep mixed currency. They keep some euros. They keep some dollars. They try to avoid the rubles because, you know, bad news can happen. It's happened recently there where they devalued rubles to nothing just a decade ago. But Russia went from one of the biggest debtor nations, basically bankruptcy. They were bankrupt in 1998 for the most part. They are now the third largest currency holder in the world because they took their natural resources back. And the way they did that is they knew they couldn't make them productive. They've been trying to do that for 70 years at the Soviet Union. So they turned them over to the oligarchs for the most part. And the oligarchs made them productive by making business partnerships with Western companies that came in and built the infrastructures. And then the oligarchs, of course, they wanted to be capitalists, and they thought that equated to corruption, so they stole a bunch of things, and the government knew they would. So they went back to the oligarchs, got them for tax evasion in some cases, in the oil industry and gas industry in particular, took back the underlying resource and told the Western companies, oh, by the way, you no longer have half of the underlying resource. You just have the contracts for the surface equipment that you built and the infrastructure, and if you don't like it, you can leave.
So you're saying they nationalized their resources then?
Yes, on the natural gas and oil on the Soviet Far East, that one particular oligarch in particular, and then they were able to then export the gas as Russian gas. And now there's a huge, huge amount of tension between the oligarchs and the Putin, still the Putin government, because it's really going to be about getting it back, because now they're essentially renationalized. And because of the bank failures in the West, the oligarchs are in trouble because they acquired great debt, and now they require a bailout. And the Russians are actually renationalizing or taking equity positions in those major companies, and they built their national strength because of it. And, you know, and I don't begrudge them, you know, for it, but was it by design or was it by default? And, you know, I think on a certain level it was by design, because they knew what they couldn't do, but they had to get the other guy to do it for them. The Chinese were even more brilliant, because they made a deal with Nixon way back, and what they did is they're using it, Sun Tzu. I mean, it's the perfect art of war. They're using our strength against us by having the illusion of capitalism in China, and we did allow, you know, they did allow capitalism, but they didn't change their ideology one bit otherwise. What did they really do is they built their productive force. They went from primitive, from buggies to bicycles to mopeds to automobiles to aircraft carriers. You know, China has gone through a change that makes them not only a billion-plus people and formidable at that, but now with the ability for $50 million to build $500 million worth of output, because the cost of production there is probably 10% of what it is here. So when you think about military expenditures, where we still screw up and buy $1,000 hammers from time to time, there they shoot you for that. You know, you know. So what they get for a billion, or in this case, $60 billion in perhaps military expenditures, might equate to $500 or $600 billion in military expenditures in the U.S. in terms of output. And that's how we should measure it. And so when you start to think about countries and how they use, you know, what are they doing? They're jockeying for their ideology, whatever that might be. In the case of the Soviet Union, they were collapsing. So they wanted to reconstitute themselves in a way where they could, you know, regain some foothold, and they did. And they did it in a pretty dramatic way that makes them the third largest currency holder in the world. And China, when you look at what they've done, anyone who's been there before and now understand that this is a formidable change that will change the balance of power in the world. And essentially, U.S. companies did it for them. And, you know, in the meanwhile, and it's like the Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, you know. I mean, there's the meatpacking plant nightmares, all the stuff. And we're buying all this stuff that turns out to be problematic because of lack of regulation, lack of infrastructure in terms of government, corruption, all the things that go along with, you know, escalating economies when they're happening this rapid. But essentially, China hasn't changed its mind about what its intentions are for the rest of the world in terms of its ideology.
Well, you say that you don't, I mean, what you were saying earlier, you didn't think that there was a big plan in all of this, but at the same time, you're mentioning Brzezinski, and, I mean, that guy's been around for a long time, heavily involved in top leadership.
And he's actually, you know, he started Trilateral Commission, which is a think tank, which is sort of the, and there are these planning think tanks, and they are there. But in terms of, you know, all these players having some intricate knowledge, yeah, there's people that are pushing, you know, I mean, I think about it this way, is we can call it a conspiracy or you can call it consensus. Because any time there's two people sitting in a room talking about something and you're standing on the outside looking in and you don't agree, it's a conspiracy. If you're sitting in the room, it's just a consensus. And it's, I guess, a matter of who's pulling the chain on which way our politics is going. And conspiracy is a word that implies a lot of things to a lot of people. If you think about these think tanks as sort of their own special interest group serving their own special interest, and you just got to figure out what that interest is, and I can guarantee you in these kinds of groups, it's not about you and me. And so you analyze their interest, you recognize that they're going to interlock with others, but I don't think it's by as much design work as a lot of people would like to give government credit for, because they don't, that they're not that organized. But there are people that are highly influential and are able to create organizational structures like the Rockefellers and others that put together organizations like the Trilateral Commission, Kissinger's, one of his prodigies, Zbigniew Brzezinski and others. Then they end up being able to develop these sort of clubs or organizations that draw the thinkers, and then they're able to direct and manipulate that thinking by the way in which they organize themselves.
Then it's on which. Then it's on which.
And everyone does this. We all do this. We join groups. We join churches. We join social clubs. But people with a lot of resources do it too, and they just happen to have the power to really affect change. And that's where that kind of power has to be checked against the power of individuals.
Okay, what I'm saying is it just depends upon which side of the fence you're on. On one side, that you will say it's a conspiracy, on the other side, it's a plan.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think about my brothers. You know, my brothers, at least two of my brothers, my youngest is out of Alaska, but my other two brothers and I get together from time to time. It's rare because we're all very busy people. But we're all highly active in our own way politically, you know, and as a consequence, we sit down and we talk, and we disagree on a lot of different issues. But the issues we agree on, you know, we sort of frame them and say, okay, what can we do? You know, what the heck can we do? And, you know, and we take steps independent of each other in some instances and try and make a difference. And I think we all do that, and the difference is we go on the airwaves. You know, we get out there and start talking to people because our sort of view of that is we can't do it alone. That's the wrong way to do it. That's where people forget that it's a democratic republic, at least in this country, and we have to find a way to reach consensus. And the first thing often is we got to first sound the alarm, let people know there's an issue here that needs to be analyzed because, you know, like we've been doing, you know, some people call us then alarmists. Because we actually pulled the alarm because the building's burning, you know, and somebody has to. And I think that's what an activist does, and I think that's what each of us is called to do in our own ways, in our own spheres of influence, whether it's influencing our family and the people at work by providing information that's meaningful and helpful and keeping the debate alive. Because that's how it happens, is each of us keeps the discussion alive and makes sure that people at least begin to recognize they do have some power to make things move a little bit differently.
One of the last videos that I was watching today had to do with a panel you were on, and had, I think, Sean David Morton, is that his name?
Yeah, that was it was in L.A. They asked me to sit in on a 2012 panel, which was kind of odd. You know, I mean, I studied a lot of that stuff because I'm interested in, you know, everything. I study a lot of different areas and have. I probably read 300 to 400. The equivalent of 300 to 400 books a year.
Oh my!
So that's a lot.
That's a book a day.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at how much I read a day, I mean, I wouldn't say it's not always in book form, but I read such a tremendous amount of material, and I don't read fiction. So, and I have a pretty good memory, and I read in a lot of disciplines. And so they asked me to sit on the panel, but you know, everyone's looking for the doom and gloom in it, and I think we're going in for some tough times. Okay, don't mistake anything I'm saying, but and I think I said it in that I think it's a time of true transition, that we have an opportunity in this decade, in this century, and this generation to totally transform this planet and our technologies and our intellects into recognizing each other in a much different way. And I think that's what 2012 is about. It's about realizing what we are as created human beings, what we have as creative capacity, and you know what quantum physics tells us. You know, we have the ability to change the wave into a particle. We have the ability as human beings to affect our reality in a profound way. And as we learn that, and we learn the mastery of that, and the more importantly, the responsibility of that, 2012 offers great opportunity. Maybe as a marker along the way to say perhaps this is the beginning of that transition. And that's what I believe. I don't believe it's all going to be doom and gloom, although it requires that, unfortunately, for most of humanity to sort of say, hey, we got to change. For all of us, me included, I mean, all of us, I think I learned the best, and I hate to say it, when things are the worst. And hopefully they become less frequent. The frequency of bad news diminishes over time if you're learning the lessons in life. I think maybe that's the rule, and perhaps in 2012 we will have learned some good lessons so that frequency of bad news can diminish for a time.
Well, you talk about the coming energy revolution that you see.
Yeah, I think this is a big thing, too. And when you think about the things that are really going to change the world, and I said this back in the 1980s, actually. It was communications, information, information, and transportation systems, and all of those, of course, require energy as their foundation. And I think energy technologies that are coming, the ones that we already know about are amazing, but I think we're going to be seeing some breakthroughs in energy that will allow us to literally bring the cost of energy almost to the floor. Like, we used to have free water, now it's the price of gasoline. But looking at that concept, The idea that you could still breathe air and not have it metered, at least in most places on the planet. I guess there's a few that are now metering air, too. But that's where energy is going to be, and I think that's going to change a lot. The other thing is superconductivity, which is another technology that's coming, and this is allows us to transfer energy from one point on the planet to another without what's called line loss, which means if you could create geothermal in one place, you can move it literally anywhere in the world efficiently, so that instead of transporting fuel and coal and oil and gas, you could move energy much differently. And these are the kinds of things I think we're going to see. Superconductivity, quantum computing, and basic fundamental understandings of energy are going to be the biggest breakthroughs that will change everything. Quantum computing also has some pitfalls, because we're going to tend to rely on these computers, because their ability to predict and model are going to become so amazing. It'll almost seem supernatural. And yet they won't be perfect. And over time, that imperfection tends to magnify, but our reliance on them will also magnify at a time when we shouldn't rely on them. So, you know, again, you know, what's the stronger, and the analogy, and I think what we have to look forward to is our fundamental change. Because once we gain control, and our technology is going to take us there because we're the ones creating them, where we begin to really explore the possibilities of the human mind and what each of us, no matter what we think of ourselves or how we limit ourselves, but how truly remarkable we are. You know, I think the biggest damage we do to ourselves, people say all the time, and I hear it a lot from friends, is, you know, if we're really created in the image of a creator, you know, that's a pretty profound statement, and yet we self-condemn all the time. You know, what a curse against the creation itself. You know, we need to start looking at ourselves as people capable of doing much, much more, and begin exploring our own individual capability and reaching our limits and finding those limits. And sometimes we find them in the worst of times. And when you think about all of these things, I think they're sort of metaphors. You know, when you think about the energy crisis, you think about what that's done. I mean, we watched oil just take us all the way up, you know, to $4 and $5 a gallon, and then boom, we're right back to where we were. And you go, how did this happen? Was it just the economy, or was it wild speculators that all of a sudden pulled their cash? I mean, what really happened here, and what are the implications of it? And the real thing that's happening is once it hits those thresholds, the alternatives kick in, and that's what was going on. And at the same time, the innovative, you know, there's countries that are never going to have the resources, and that's where the real energy breakthroughs are going to come. They're not going to come in the way in which traditionally you would expect the market to make it happen, because there's too many market forces that prefer that it didn't. But again, I think that's one of those fundamental areas. Energy, that's going to change a great deal about what's happening in the world. I mean, you think about food and refrigeration. If energy is cheap enough, then you've got all kinds of other problems starting to be solved.
Well, they say that we're about 40 or 50 years ahead in what is really common knowledge among the people. Do you feel that?
That's probably true. You know, that's, and I think it varies a lot over the planet. I mean, there's a lot of places around the planet that operate like we think of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. I mean, and by choice and not in a negative way, because I think people have, again, we make a lot of mistakes. I work here in Alaska with tribal governments and have over my career at various intervals, and we misunderstand. When we go into areas, we start making judgments based on what we see through our filter and through our experience. And what we see and we judge as poverty and misery, often it's not the case. It might be from where we come from through our filter, but where we are at that moment in that culture, in that place on the planet, might in fact, by the people that live there, be viewed as prosperity and success. And so I think we need to allow people to self-determine. Not everybody needs to be a market. Not everybody needs to become a taxpayer. Not everybody needs to be urbanized our way. Not everybody wants a McDonald's, you know, and I think that's where, again, the corporations do us a disservice, because they go with that message. Most Americans don't believe that. We believe in leaving people predominantly alone as long as they're not messing with anyone else. And, you know, that's the way the country was formed. But other interests view the world differently. There's resources they want to take. There's people they want to exploit. There's situations that drive them that have nothing to do with the human beings. And again, we got to get back to the humanity of these technologies, make sure they serve our purposes, and that requires active people in government and a change in the way we see our science. And we need to start impacting young people. The very brilliant are the ones who contemplate these things, and they're the most capable of making change. One brilliant person leaving a government program to go do something else can collapse a sinister direction and enhance a better one. And I think people are starting to think about that. And I've seen some people actually make that choice. And maybe that's the wave that begins in 2012.
So you think that the majority of the scientists out there really have a grip on what is really going on out there with their technologies, or you just, you know, are they?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of them operate without that knowledge, and by the time many who reach that level of knowledge, they are so entrapped in the system, they have to decide whether they're willing to take the risk, the sacrifice that goes with that whistleblowing or disclosure or walking away. And I think we need new institutions to take care of that. I think we need whistleblowing institutions that actually work, that are outside of government, that have the power of subpoena, that have the ability to step in, protect individuals when there's something to be said, whether it's government or corporations or private parties. There needs to be a way that when science is being either restricted or used in a way that damages humanity or poses a risk to the public, that people have a way to bring that forward, and not just in that area. And I think there needs to be a time of forgiveness, a time of healing. You know, similar to what happened in South Africa. You know, people did a lot of horrible things there, but they allowed, at the end of it, people to come forward and confess, be forgiven, and move on, and at least have the full knowledge so people could go on. And two huge attributes of humanity were shown in that. One is the ability to come forward and admit, and the second is the ability to forgive. And those that didn't, you know, and that were identified later, they got harsh penalties, you know, for not moving forward. And maybe we need some of that. Maybe that will be one of the outcomes of some of the things that we're going to experience in the next few years, is that there will be ways to sort of purge what has happened and then create mechanisms to avoid it in the future. And, you know, we'll go through cycles. I think that's the nature of humanity. But we have a very important responsibility now, because the technology we hold can destroy this planet for people that we know we don't have any animosity to. And those are our great-great-grandchildren out there, the ones we haven't even met yet. And if we start to think about what we're doing in light of who those people are, the inheritors of what we leave them, maybe we'll take a different view of our technology, and we can thrive. I mean, I don't think there needs to be shortage, and that's a big, big mistake along many lines, is we're given the illusion of scarcity when, in fact, it has to do with the way in which we start to develop and we start to look at our science, and we make sure good science moves forward, and the opportunity to solve some of these big problems that enhance the living experience of people is what humanity should be about.
Katie, do you have any closing questions or anything?
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Now, your website, would you give us your website again?
Sure. It's EarthPulse, EarthPulse, EarthPulse.com. And you'll see all our books, all our videos and publications, a lot of free material. If you value what we do, pick up a book, take a look at it. When you're done with it, send it to your congressman. Send it to somebody else that will act on it. And, you know, take the information and use it. Let's make this thing change. Each of us has a role to play, and I think we can do some really good things if we just step up and do the things that we believe to be right and true, and begin to express that in our spheres of influence, whatever those might be.
And do you also have access from earthpulse.com over to the harp.net?
I don't have a link. You can do any kind of search on HARP. We'll find the HARP site, the official site. But we have quite a few articles on HARP on the website at earthpulse.com, and those are free. Again, a lot of good material there. We have video on HARP. We have a book on the subject. Both are good and give people a good background. You know, some people are better with the visual information than they are with the book form. So we really started looking at that medium. And so many young people prefer that it became important to get the message out. So I encourage folks to go there, take a look at what is available, and support us in that way. And maybe we can see a little bit different direction in the way these technologies go.
And I encourage all the listeners to really take a look at these books. And they are Controlling the Human Mind, Earth Rising 1 and 2, and Angels Don't Play This Harp.
And Dr. Begich, I really want to thank you for coming on the program, and I hope that in the future we can have you back again.
Well, I look forward to it, and I appreciate the time, and I know we kind of went far afield in some of the areas, and that's the way these things go, but, you know, politics is in everyone's mind right now, and, you know, all of this does really interrelate. We live in a complex world, but, you know, it's always going to boil down to individuals. At least I hope it continues to boil down to individuals, and one can do a great deal. Every good thing started with somebody saying, hey, wait a minute, we see it just a little bit differently.
Well, again, thank you both, Katie and Dr. Begich.
Thank you, Dr. Begich.
Thanks. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.